Okay. So let us continue with the Bhaya Bhairava Sutta, the Fear and Dread Sutta. And again, it is about kind of establishing the right qualities for solitude, which means also really establishing the right qualities for like letting go and for meditation, because all of these things are related to each other. Yeah, the idea of letting go, the idea of nekama, which is renunciation, is very often related to the idea of solitude, because you renounce to live in solitude, and you live in solitude to renounce. They kind of go around each other. And all of these things are related to meditation practice. So all of these things revolve around each other. So even though this is a bit more than what we do here at the retreat center here, a bit kind of higher degree of solitude, it is still a similar kind of ideas that are required for, you know, developing the mind in the right way. So there's a couple of more qualities to go before we can move on in the sutta. And I will summarize these qualities in a second. The last thing we looked at was the idea of mindfulness and situational awareness, or a lack of that being a problem. And then the next one is there are ascetics and Brahmins who lack stillness, who have straying minds, but I am accomplished in stillness. Yeah, and stillness here is the idea of samadhi. And straying minds, vibhanta citta, literally means the mind that goes all over the place. Vibhanta is another word for disrobing in Pali. Vibhanta means you kind of go off in the wrong direction. That's kind of the idea for disrobing in Buddhism. It means you have kind of lost your way a little bit. You're straying. And this is a suitable word from the Buddhist point of view of what disrobing means. So again, the idea of samadhi, as I mentioned before, with sati. Sati is like a ruler of the mind. And if sati is a ruler of the mind, samadhi, the stillness, is even more of a ruler. You feel like you are in charge of your life. You feel, instead of being kind of bullied around and buffeted around by all the defilements all the time, it feels like you are in control of yourself. And this is really nice. Yeah, this is kind of, if you want to talk about free will in Buddhism, this is a kind of idea of free will. Because now you can actually make real choices. You can actually decide what you want to think. You can decide what you don't want to think. And so often we feel like we are the victims of our thoughts. And at this point, you are no longer a victim, because you feel that you are in control of your mind. You go to the Vitakka Santana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which Vitakka Santana means the calming of thoughts, and it gives you all these various ways of calming the thinking mind. And at the very end of the sutta, it says that you are become the master of thought, and you think those thoughts that you want to think, and you don't think those thoughts that you don't want to think. Yeah, that's kind of nice, isn't it? Being able to think exactly what you want instead of being controlled by some other things like the defilements and external things or whatever it might be. The sense of being in charge of yourself. And this in Buddhism, if anything is free will in Buddhism, this is the idea of free will, because now you can make meaningful choices in your life. Whether there is any free will in any deeper sense is a fraught subject and interesting in its own right, maybe a little bit philosophical. It doesn't matter so much. But at least you are, the sense of being in charge is what matters. And whether you ultimately are free or not is kind of irrelevant, as long as you can choose those things that are useful for you. So this is samadhi. It allows you that choice because the mind is still, the mind is pure, the mind is mindful. You see things arising before they come up, and then you can take the countermeasure to make sure that you are retain that sense of independence and purity in your mind. So samadhi being very, very useful on the path. For so many different reasons, and we've seen some of those reasons before, and here is another one. It enables that practice living in solitude. And then comes the very last of these factors. There are ascetics and Brahmins who are witless and stupid. who frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest. Those ascetics and Brahmins, they summon unskillful fear and dread because of the defects of witlessness and stupidity. But I don't frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest, witless and stupid. I am accomplished in wisdom. I am one of those noble ones who frequent the remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest, accomplished in wisdom. Seeing this accomplishment of wisdom in myself, I felt even more unruffled about staying in the forest. Witlessness and stupidity. What does that mean in Buddhism? What does it mean to be wise? And what does it mean to be stupid? And the stupid here, in a sense of maybe foolish might be a better word, the opposite of wisdom is really what it means. There are a couple of different ways you can think about the idea of wisdom. One of the very important ways that you see throughout the suttas is understanding the causality of things, being able to make out cause and effect. If there is a problem, why is there that problem? And you can see this is what the Buddha does again and again in the suttas, trying to understand why, what are the defects of the mind, how do they arise, what are the causes of the problem, why is there suffering, why, etc., etc. Always looking into causes. And this is kind of one of the signs of wisdom, having that ability to discern the causes of things. This is almost the opposite of having an idea of a self. If you have an idea of a self, that there is something that you have an inherent essence or whatever it might be, then you don't look into causality to the same degree, because certain things will not have causes when there is a self. The self is kind of in charge, and the self doesn't have any further causes, and so there is no possibility of looking into causality. So it takes that degree of understanding, the degree of understanding of non-self already at this particular point to enable you to look for the causes in the right way. And so this is one aspect of wisdom, this ability to look at the causes all the time, be clear about what the causes are. Another very simple way of thinking about wisdom in Buddhism is the idea of discerning the difference between happiness and suffering. We talked about this before, because everything really revolves about that, around that. Everyone wants to be happy in the world. Everyone wants to have fewer problems. Everyone wants to be more content, to have more goodwill, to have all of these positive qualities. This is what everybody wants. So if you're able to discern that, that which in many ways is the very meaning of life for people, if you have insight into the meaning of life, into happiness and suffering, that is kind of an aspect of wisdom. So these are two ways of thinking about the idea of wisdom in Buddhism, causality and understanding happiness and suffering in life. And of course, this is very helpful if you are in the if you are in the forest by yourself and there are problems and there are possibilities of becoming fearful. You can imagine if you're in the forest by yourself, it's easy to become fearful when you hear strange things or whatever. And having the ability to see the causality obviously is very useful in that particular context, because you can see what actually goes on rather than being led astray by imagination and the mind kind of doing silly things, playing tricks with you, which is what the mind does in this kind of situation. So that is the last one of these qualities. Now, if you look back on these qualities that we have looked at, you will recognize that they are the five hindrances are basically there. We talked about desires, about ill will, restlessness. We talked about tiredness and lethargy, and also about doubt. So all the five hindrances are there. And then on the positive side, we see the qualities that are very similar to the five spiritual faculties: energy, mindfulness, stillness of the mind, and wisdom. The faith is missing, but you can sort of argue that faith is sort of implied by not having any doubt. Because doubt is almost like the opposite of faith in this particular case. You have confidence, it means you are clear about things, whereas doubt is being unclear and being uncertain. So they're kind of opposites. So These two sets of qualities are often juxtaposed against each other. Usually what it is, it's usually the five hindrances is juxtaposed with the seven factors of awakening here. Yeah, and the seven factors of awakening are all these beautiful qualities, mindfulness, investigation of phenomena, energy, joy, peace or tranquility of the mind, stillness and equanimity. These are the seven factors of awakening here. And the seven factors of awakening are almost always opposed to the five hindrances in the suttas. So as we reduce the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening start to arise on their own, in their own right. And when you develop the seven factors of awakening, you are reducing the five hindrances. So these are like two different ways of thinking about the development of the mind. We've been focusing a lot on the idea of overcoming the defilements or the hindrances. But another way of looking at it is developing the seven factors of awakening, and that actually overcomes the hindrances. So overcome the hindrances and the factors of awakening arise, or develop the factors of awakening and the hindrances tend to decrease. Yeah, two kind of alternative ways of doing it. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that if you feel defilements in the mind and you are able to overcome that by reflecting wisely, then you will also give rise to the factors of awakening. On the other hand, if you can give rise to joy by reflecting on the Buddha and the Dhamma, or that you're living well, that very reflection will also tend to overcome the hindrances. So you have like two different approaches to developing the mind. There are two kind of alternatives that sort of work together in this way. Here we're seeing a slightly different thing. Here we're seeing the five spiritual faculties. But the five spiritual faculties are very closely related to the seven factors of awakening. So you see a similar kind of opposition between hindrances and factors of awakening here. So the idea is that if you want to practice the Dhamma properly, if you want to live in solitude, you want to have as many of these factors of awakening in the mind, as many of these spiritual faculties as strong as possible, and you want to have the hindrances as low as possible, as little as possible. This is kind of the idea here. And then there is a few additional qualities that are also added here, like labha, sakkara, siloka, gain, honor, and fame. And what else did we have here? Being cowardly was in there, and those were kind of the two things. And glorifying yourself and putting others down. So all of these things have to do with a kind of self-view, how you deal with yourself. And you don't want to have too much ego when you go into solitude. It's going to make life very difficult for you. So this gives an idea of the qualities that you want to develop for meditation to work and for the spiritual path to work. So that is what the Buddha sees in himself. And because he sees that in himself, he then assumes that he is ready to go into the forest and to practice accordingly. That's why he is unruffled, as it says here, about staying in the forest. And that's what he does. Then he goes on, the next thing he says that I thought there are certain nights that are recognized as especially portentous, like auspicious or whatever, the 14th, the 15th, and the 8th of the fortnight. On such nights, why don't I stay in awe-inspiring and hair-raising shrines in parks, forests, and trees? In such lodgings, perhaps I might see that fear and dread. Sometime later, that's what I did. And as I was staying there, a deer came by. A peacock snapped a twig, or the wind rustled the leaves. Then I thought, is that the fear and dread coming? Then I thought, why do I always expect, or why do I always want the fear and dread to come? Why don't I get rid of that fear and dread just as it come, while remaining just as I am? Then that fear and dread came upon me as I was walking, and I didn't stand still or sit down or lie down until I had got rid of that fear and dread while walking. So let's just stop there, because there's a lot going on here. And of course, the first thing that I mentioned throughout is again this idea that the Buddha to be, you can see his humanity there. He's like everyone else. And if you go into some kind of awe-inspiring, fear-inducing place, you can expect some kind of fear to arise, some kind of anxiety or whatever. So again, it kind of shows us that the Buddha is very close to us in so many ways. In fact, in all of these human ways, you recognize the psychology of the Buddha to be said the same as us, or we have the same psychology as the Buddha to be. So again, it's kind of reassuring. The Buddha understands us, and you can ask questions from the Buddha by inquiring into the suttas or whatever. But the thing that kind of makes the Buddha special, and the Buddha to be special, is his willingness to kind of go all out in his search for awakening. He doesn't really hold back at all. He goes into the forest by himself, and he chooses kind of the most difficult things. He kind of really does the hardest thing that's possible. And he, on these portentous nights, the 14th, the 15th, and the 8th of the fortnight. So what is it about these nights, the 14th and the 15th? And well, these are the new moon and the full moons. This is according to the lunar calendar of ancient India. And this lunar calendar is still followed by monastics. So if you, one of the things you have to learn as a monastic is the kind of the lunar calendar. So you learn how many fortnights or 15 days there are, and how many fortnights or 14 days, the various seasons according to the lunar calendar, and these kind of things. This is part of what you learn as a monastic, and kind of getting in tune with the ancient Indian calendar, following the cycles of the moon. And the reason for that is because on the new moon and the full moon, that is when the monastics, you recite the Patimokkha, you recite the rules of discipline that we follow as monastics. So you need to have some idea how to work out these calendars. And then you have to add a month every 2 or 3 years. You have to add a month, because the lunar year is much shorter than the solar year. It's actually 11 days shorter. So every year you lose 11 days. And so then you have to add another extra month. And these are the sort of things that you learn. And then there's some intricate system. You have to also add an extra day sometimes. And I have never actually mastered that particular calculation, so I'm not sure exactly how that is done. But these days it's done by the governments around the world actually do these calculations in Buddhist countries, and they tell you the days, so you don't really have to worry too much about it. But there's a way of calculating these things as well. And the reason why the monastics do chant the rules on that day, and the reason, one of the things that was also done on those days, was that there were Dhamma talks were given on these days. And this is an ancient custom in India prior to Buddhism. And there was a story in the Vinaya Pitaka of King Bimbisara of Magadha. He would go to the Buddha and say, why don't the Buddhist monastics also give Dhamma talks on the new moon and the full moon days? Because this inspires the lay people. And King Bimbisara was saying to the Buddha, all of these other religions, they do this. And all of these other kind of religions, even though they may not be as inspiring as Buddhism, they gain all of these followers because of that. And so you should be doing the same. And then the Buddha institutes this idea of giving Dhamma talks on the new moon and the full moon. And this is what you find even in the present day in traditional Buddhist countries. You can go to the monastery and you can hear a Dhamma talk on the new moon and the full moon. It's only here in Australia we don't do that, because we kind of follow more the ordinary weekday is the weekends, but that is a traditional way of doing things. And it is very inspiring, when you have the full moon coming out. And you may, I don't know if you have walked around the forest during the full moon. It's really inspiring. The kind of the light is there, it's a very gentle kind of light. And it's very kind of beautiful to walk around in the moonlight. Something you don't see in the city because of all the light pollution. But certainly in Bodhidharma Monastery you see the shadows of the trees. And you can very easily walk around just by the moonlight. And then you can carry on meditating easily. Yeah, at night, even if you haven't got any light, you carry on. So these were the days when you listened to Dhamma talks, when you would do meditation practice. And because you would be inspired by the full moon or whatever. Either you're inspired or you go a little bit nuts, right? The full moon is kind of famous, has this kind of, you're never really sure what's going to happen. One way or another, something is going to happen, that's for sure. So this is the idea. And then, of course, we have the new moon. Yeah, the new moon when it is completely dark. And I don't know if you have been in the forest when it is really absolutely pitch black. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of good fun. Yeah, sometimes I forget my torch and I have to walk back to my hut in the forest without a torch, and it's pitch black, and you can literally have to walk like this, and with you feeling the forest, you don't get any trees in your eyes, and that kind of stuff. Trees in your eyes are not recommended. That's kind of a bad idea. So these are inspiring days. Yeah, these are things that were considered special at that time, and even in the present day. The 14th and the 15th day here, the lunar month is about 29 and a half days long. Yeah. Yeah, so you have a fortnight, then you have a 15 day, and then you have another 15 day, and another 15, and then you have a 14 day. So every fourth is a 14 day, and then a 15 day. Yeah, these are the so-called lunar fortnights. And then you have the 8th. The 8th is when you have the half moon. Yeah, the half moon. That's also considered an auspicious day as well. Yeah. So the Buddha would go on these days, that were especially auspicious. And of course, on these days, there would be people, they would go to these shrines in the forest. These are called chaitya, these shrines. And these shrines could often just be a tree, or they could be maybe a special grove, a clump of trees. There may be something built up, but not necessarily. And then they would go and they would leave some food, maybe for their ancestors or something like that. So when we're talking about shrines, we're also talking about ghosts, right? This is kind of the point here, yeah? The ghosts, they frequent these places because the ghosts are kind of waiting for the donations of food, yeah, from the relatives, so they can kind of feed on in the ghost realm. So that's why the Buddha hangs out there, so he can see a few more ghosts, yeah, or whatever happens at that time. So this is the idea, yeah? It is kind of you're maximizing the chances for fear and dread to arise. Yeah, it's kind of can be scary enough to be in the forest all by yourself in the middle of the night. But then if you add a few ghosts into the equation, yeah, it makes it even more interesting. Yeah, and so this is kind of the idea behind this. Forest shrines deep into the forest. I don't know if any one of you, if you can sort of make a horror movie out of this, I think, quite easily. This is the... maybe this is kind of the one of the original horror movies. Maybe it came from a script straight out of the Buddha Suttas. I'm not sure. There's so many things in the Buddha Suttas that seems to be many things happened in Buddhism before it happened anywhere else. Anyway, so he does this. And then as he was staying in such a place, he's thinking, maybe I will see that fear and dread. Yeah, he's kind of trying, he's testing himself to see if the fear and dread will arise. He has already overcome so many of the defilements of the mind, but the fear and dread might still be there. He's been testing himself to the limit. This is kind of the Buddha to be, why he's so special there. You can see what is going on here. Even if you have no defilements in the mind, the sense of self is very vulnerable when you are in this kind of position. Yeah, because the sense of self, you want to protect yourself. And even if there are other defilements in the realm of the five senses are kind of put aside, the sense of self will give rise to fear and dread in this kind of situations. So this is really testing yourself all the way to the limit to see what happens. And this is how then you uncover deeper problems, right? By that very fact of testing. And this, of course, is the whole purpose of what the Buddha is doing here. And then you have And this is kind of, this is really nice. This is, sounds really real, right? He says then, as he's waiting for that fear and dread, sometime later, as he was staying, a deer would come by, a peacock would snap a twig, yeah? Or the wind would rustle the leaves, yeah? And I'm sure you know what it is like when you cannot see anything. The sense of hearing becomes very acute because you are guided by hearing, you're guided by the other senses when the sense of sight is gone. And so suddenly all the sounds in the world are amplified enormously, and the rustling of the leaves in the wind sounds like a ghost or something dangerous approaching, right? The peacock snapping a twig, which you wouldn't even recognize when you could see what was going on, suddenly becomes something really scary. What is going on there? What is happening there? And this is kind of the nature of our minds, to kind of imagine things, to create phantoms out of nothing. And this is the way things are. And it's very obvious when you stay in the forest at night, you can actually see this happening very, very easily. One of the things that you notice here in Australia is that you notice how kangaroos, they sound often like human beings. Yeah, especially not when they jump, but when they kind of walk, yeah, when they walk along, they sound a bit like human beings. They have a similar kind of sound, a similar kind of way of moving. Yeah. And so sometimes you're sitting in your cootie or on your walking path and you think, oh, that's a human being coming here. And actually, no, it's just a kangaroo. There are many more kangaroos in the forest than there are human beings where we are. And many more kangaroos than there are ghosts. Or maybe not. Yeah, that is that is uncertain. We don't know how many ghosts there are in that forest. So the sounds really play with you in this way, and this is exactly what the Buddha is doing here. I'm sure you know that story with Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm tells a story when he was in a cemetery or a charnel ground in Thailand. And the charnel ground is a place where they will burn the corpses. This is kind of the traditional way of doing things. And so they build up this funeral pyre and they kind of whack the corpse on top and they light the pyre and kind of the whole thing burns down. But very often the corpse, it would also be left in the charnel ground. Yeah, and they'd be left there for a while or whatever. And people would only go there during the day. No one would go to the charnel ground at night. Why? Because there were so many ghosts in those charnel grounds. People were absolutely terrified of these charnel grounds. And especially I understand that in Thai culture, from the moment you are born until the moment you die, you hear endless ghost stories. And because you hear endless ghost stories, it means that you are terrified of ghosts because you've heard everything that happens when ghosts are around. In Western culture, you don't hear so many ghost stories, so people from a Western background don't tend to be quite so afraid of charnel grounds. Yeah? So Ajahn Brahm said, okay, I'm going to go to this charnel ground. I'm going to sit there and meditate all night, to test myself, a bit like the Buddha maybe here or whatever it is. And then when he says that to the Thai monks say, no, don't go to the charnel ground, yeah? And they were kind of holding him back. Yeah, please, be here, you're going to be safe here, yeah? This is much better than the charnel ground. The Thai monks thought this was too dangerous. This was going too far to test yourself to this, to this extent. But of course, Ajahn Brahm being Ajahn Brahm, I'm going to go to the charnel ground and test myself fully. And so he goes to this charnel ground and he kind of has this little platform. This is one of the ways they would set themselves up in the forest. He sits on this platform and he has a mosquito net over so that he doesn't get eaten by mosquitoes. And then he sits there and he happily meditates as the sun goes down. And then when the sun has finally gone down, he hears rustling in the leaves. That's exactly what the Buddha is hearing. He hears rustling in the leaves. And he listens, what could that rustling in the leaves be? It's only a small animal, probably a mouse or something, not to worry. So he carries on meditating, and then the rustling in the leaves becomes a bit louder. What could it be? Maybe a little bit larger than a mouse. Maybe it's one of these civet cats or whatever that kind of live in the forest in Thailand. That's probably what it is. It's not dangerous, no need to worry. So he continues meditating, and the rustling in the leaves becomes even louder. And so then he thinks, probably civet cat is too small. This may be a dog. Yeah, maybe a dog we're talking about. Yeah, okay, dogs are not so nice, some of these dogs, but that's okay. I can deal with a dog. Yeah. So he carries on meditating. Yeah. And then the rustling gets even louder. Yeah, and this is when he starts, well, what could this be? It's not a mouse, not a civet cat, not a dog. What is larger than the dog? Tiger. Must be a tiger. Surely this is a tiger. Yeah. And at this point, he starts to kind of, I'm never sure if Ajahn Brahm's stories are true or not. But anyway, this is what he tells, right? This is kind of his story. Huh? He always exaggerates and all kind of things. But one of Ajahn Brahm's famous principles is never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So that kind of tells you a little bit about the trustworthiness of his stories. But anyway, so, and then of course, if it is a tiger, yeah, at this point, he's no longer willing just to kind of to chillax and meditate. So he gets his torch out and he kind of shaking and shines the light into the forest. And what does he see? He sees a tiny mouse right there on the edge of his little platform, right? And everything else was just his imagination. And imagination builds up a story that, of course, is completely untrue. And this is exactly what is happening here to the Buddha to be. Yeah? Exactly the same thing. Yeah? The building up of the imagination, the fear, the sense of self, feeling threatened in one way or another. Yeah? And that is what is going on here. Yeah? So the Buddha is testing himself to the limit. And when. So then what happens is that. Again, he thinks, is this that fear and dread coming when you hear the rustling in the leaves? And then I thought, why do I always want that fear and dread to come? I'm retranslating a little bit here because I think there are different ways of translating this. Why don't I get rid of that fear and dread just as it comes while remaining just as I am? Yeah, and then that fear and dread came upon me as I was walking here. Okay, yeah, whatever. I didn't stand still, sit down or lie down until I had got rid of that fear and dread while walking here. Yeah, so this is kind of the way that the Buddha to be practices. Yeah, he is not willing to kind of stop until he has overcome this. The whole purpose of this is to overcome the defilements of the mind, to understand the problems, to understand the issues with the sense of self. This is the point. You challenge yourself to the absolute maximum. And then no way you're going to even sit down until you have overcome that fear and dread. That is the purpose of this whole practice. And this is kind of what makes the Buddha to be unique. Yeah, this willingness to take everything to an extreme, to challenge himself fully, to resolve all of these kind of underlying issues that might be there, trying to find a way through. Yeah, and of course, the idea here is to learn something from this, how to overcome defilements of the mind. And of course, he succeeds through that wisdom, looking into causality, why am I afraid? And then he realizes that actually it's just my imagination playing with me or whatever. And then he lets go of that fear and dread as a consequence. Then that fear and dread came upon me as I was standing. I didn't walk or sit down or lie down until I had got rid of that fear and dread while standing. Then that fear and dread came upon me as I was sitting. I didn't lie down or stand still or walk until I got rid of that fear and dread while sitting. Then that fear and dread came upon me as I was lying down. I didn't sit up or stand still or walk until I got rid of that fear and dread while lying down. So there you are. This is how the Buddha practices. And this is kind of the idea here of how we sometimes we need to sort of do things to a very high extent to really have success on the Buddhist path. And I think one of the kind of the things in our life as spiritual practitioners is that we sometimes need to challenge ourselves. We shouldn't always be happy with the way things are. We shouldn't always be happy trying to find safety all the time and trying to find the easy way always. Because sometimes it is when you are challenged that actually you uncover things, you do things that are different. And that is why it is great for you to, wonderful that you come here to Jhana Grove, yeah, a 9-day retreat. That, for many people, that can be challenging, especially if it is the first time you do it. Maybe you had some doubts before coming here, yeah, and maybe thought that this could be difficult to be quiet for 9 days, and for many people it is. So good on you, as they say, for coming here and testing yourself a little bit. Yeah? It's a wonderful thing. And you may find out that it is a bit challenging, or you may find that it is wonderful and that you're really enjoying these 9 days. Yeah, a little bit up and down, of course, but you may find that you're enjoying it. And regardless whether you enjoy it or whether you find it challenging, you're going to grow as a consequence of doing this. So challenges are good in life, and we should not always seek the easy way. That's why when things get difficult, it is a great opportunity to learn. Whenever things are difficult, like we had this fellow coming in here, is always a great opportunity to learn something. And if all you do when these difficult things happen is kind of turn against it and become upset, then you're not taking that opportunity to learn something. Because this is life. Life is like this. And this affords you that opportunity. And I have always found that in my life, if I face those challenges rather than try to run away from them, actually I learn so much from that. So this is what the Buddha does, and this is what we should all do. So take opportunities. Don't be too fearful in your life. Fear is debilitating, and it often destroys that courage that is required sometimes to practice the path fully. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who perceive that it's day when in fact it's night. Or they perceive that it's night when in fact it's day. This meditation of theirs is delusion, I say. I perceive that it's night when in fact it is night. I perceive that it's day when in fact it is day. And if there's anyone of whom it may be rightly said that a being not liable to delusion has arisen in the world for the welfare and happiness of the people, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans, it is of me that this should be said. So the idea here is that the Buddha is not delusional, right? He is someone who is not liable to delusion. If there's anyone who is not liable to delusion, it is precisely the Buddha. You can see here, this is exactly the point of these kind of things that he's doing here. Testing himself in the forest is to overcome the delusions, to gain clarity, to understand what is going on, to overcome the defilements, and to become clear about things. That's kind of the point of all of this. This idea of non-delusion is, I think, fundamental for success. Certainly success on the spiritual path, but really success for anything in life. If you are going to be successful, you have to see the world straight as it actually is, so that you can act according to what the world is like. Whatever area you want to be successful in, right? If you're going to be a good sports person, you have to understand how to train to become successful. If you're going to be a good business person, you have to know how to deal with people, to make business deals or whatever. You have to understand the world as it is. So non-delusion is one of those fundamental aspects that is required for any kind of success. But especially so on the spiritual path, because on the spiritual path, we're going to even deeper things, trying to actually really see the mind and everything according to reality as it actually is. So very important on the spiritual path not to be delusional. So how can we avoid being delusional? How can we be more clear about things in our life? Yeah, avoiding this problem of the mind going astray, getting confused or whatever it is. The problem with delusion is that delusion tends to beget more delusion. If you are deluded, it leads to more delusion down the track, because delusion doesn't really know itself. But sometimes you do. Sometimes you get a glimpse. Sometimes you get a glimpse that you don't really understand. Sometimes you kind of you see that, actually, wait a minute, I don't really know what's going on here. And when you get those glimpses, it is important to acknowledge that. And there's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says that the person who understands their ignorance is wise to that extent, because they have a feeling that actually there's something I'm missing out on here. I don't really understand. I need some spiritual teachings. I need some help to kind of sort myself out. That is a degree of wisdom, understanding your own delusion, understanding your own ignorance. But the person who is ignorant about their ignorance, who is deluded about their delusion, well, there isn't any real hope, because they don't really have that, they won't have any motivation to overcome the delusion, because they don't even know it exists. So having a feeling that you are deluded, that you don't see things clearly, is already a kind of wisdom. This is kind of one aspect. Another way of dealing with a delusion and moving in the right direction to get more clarity in your life is to be very honest with yourself. Sometimes we need that kind of brutal honesty on the spiritual path, not to be afraid of uncovering our own weaknesses and understanding ourselves as we actually are. And it can be very painful, because we like to have ideas about ourselves as good people. And of course, everyone here is a good person. You are, because otherwise you wouldn't be here, right? So you are all good people. Usually I ask if there are any bad people, but there's no point, because I know what the answer is anyway. But so people here are good people. And still, somehow, our sense of self doesn't always like to be challenged. Are there some bad qualities in me? Are there things I need to overcome? It is difficult to accept that. And yet, it is so important on this path. And so the fact that you are a good person already, that you're living a good life, that you're intending the right thing, you're inclining in the right direction, otherwise you wouldn't be here, that should give you the grounding that allows you to be more honest about yourself. Because you already know that you're on the right track. Okay, that means I have a good foundation that should allow me to be more honest about myself. And then when we are honest about ourselves, then we can overcome some of these deep-seated bad habits that may block progress on the path. Sometimes it can be really, really hard to see. And sometimes it can be very useful to listen to other people. If someone blames you, or someone points out a flaw in your character, how do you react? Do you get upset or think, I don't want to hear that from you? Or do you say, thank you, teacher? Very few people say, thank you, teacher, right? But sometimes that may very well be the right approach. Because sometimes, a lot of the time, people, when they blame us or they kind of point out a flaw in us, a lot of the time it's just out of anger or ill will or whatever. And of course, in those cases, you can just dismiss it. It doesn't matter. It's kind of irrelevant. But it is not always the case. Sometimes people may actually point to something really fundamental that actually is a problem. So it is useful to listen to other people and ask ourselves in a deep way, could it be that they have a point about this? And then it can be very painful initially, but then over time you also understand that actually they have pointed out a treasure. Because it is a treasure when you are pointed out a flaw that you otherwise were not able to see. Once you overcome it, it allows you to practice the path. And of course, developing the path is like finding a treasure. This is the highest treasure in the world. So the other person is allowing you to find a treasure by pointing out your weaknesses. So never waste an opportunity. When someone point something out to you, especially when they do it in a nice way, when you feel that they have your best interest at heart, especially at those times, listen. could it be that they have that they are right? And then if you recognize that they are right, and take a bit of time to reflect on it, then you can go back to them later on and say, thank you. Yeah, thank you for pointing that. Actually, it was extremely helpful there. And that's kind of a nice thing to do. It's kind of very counter to how people normally live their life and how they react to criticism or pointing out of weaknesses. This is the right way of dealing with this. Of course, you have to be careful. You have to protect yourself. You shouldn't overdo this kind of self-criticism, because if you do that, you start to feel bad about yourself. And it's not really useful anyway. But occasionally, when the time is right, then you listen. And then maybe you can uncover something beautiful. And I have found this in my own life, that sometimes people have said things, and I thought, wait a minute, maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe I have this problem. Maybe I should do something about it. It has actually been very, very beneficial down the track. So this is the idea of non-delusion. Being very careful, being very circumspect, reflecting, being honest with ourselves, what is actually going on. And then gradually, we can get us out of this almost impossible situation, because delusion tends to be blind to itself. We can actually gradually uncover these things. So Buddha uses this idea here, the simile of some ascetics and Brahmins, they perceive day when in fact it's night, or they perceive night when in fact it's day. And this could be a reference to a meditation practice that they were using. You see brightness when it's dark, or you see darkness when it's bright. And I guess what he's saying is that kind of meditation is kind of pointless. All it does is it turns things upside down, but it doesn't really have any effect apart from that. So instead of deluding ourselves in that way, we want to see things clearly. It is used, as I think, mostly as a simile here for what delusion is like. So the Buddha, instead, he sees day when it's day and night when it's night. If anyone not liable to delusion has arisen in the world for the welfare of everyone, the people, the gods and everyone, that is the Buddha. Always seeing things in the carefully studying and looking at the world, and then making decisions on that basis. And we have seen this throughout. When he was young, he was contemplating old age already when he was in his 20s. That's kind of pretty cool. 20s already, thinking about old age, thinking about illness, thinking about all of these kind of things, death. Facing up to the realities of existence from the very beginning. And that is what enabled the Buddha to become a Buddha, because of that clarity about the nature of existence. It's kind of interesting, Buddhism. I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago at Dhammaloka Center, where I talked about the things that make Buddhism special and unique in the history of human thought. One of the things that makes Buddhism kind of unique is that it is a naturalistic religion. It's about seeing nature, understanding nature. It is not about anything outside of nature. Everything is within nature. And when we understand nature properly, that is what non-delusion is about. That is actually when we reach this idea of awakening or understanding. But everything is within nature. So in that sense, it is similar to science, because science is a study of nature, and Buddhism is also the study of nature, of things as they actually are. Nothing is outside of nature. We may have a slightly different idea of what nature is. It includes the mind, it includes more things, but it's still nature. Anyway, so then the Buddha says, my energy was roused up and unflagging. My mindfulness was established and lucid. My body was tranquil and undisturbed. And my mind was stilled in samadhi. So these are, you can see here again, these are some of the spiritual faculties and also the awakening factors. It's a slightly different sequence of things. You have the energy, mindfulness, tranquility, and samadhi. These are largely awakening factors, but in a slightly different sequence from usual, from what you usually have. So when you overcome the defilements, this is what happens. The awakening factors arise as a consequence. The energy of the mind gets roused up and is unflagging. Yeah, mindfulness is established. You are clear. The mindfulness is there with you. The defilements are gone, no longer leading you astray. And the mindfulness keeps it that way. The body is tranquil and undisturbed. It's like when you sit down and the meditation is going well. You don't want to get up anymore. You feel really solid in your meditation. You just want to sit there forever and ever and ever. That's when you know your meditation is going well. Body is tranquil and undisturbed. When the Buddha uses this terminology, the Buddha doesn't use words in a kind of superficial sense. When the Buddha says something, it has a very deep meaning. So undisturbed and tranquil really means undisturbed and tranquil. It doesn't, it's the real deal, so to speak. It's slightly understated. The Buddha is always a bit understated. And that's an important thing to remember when you interpret the suttas. I once said that the Buddha is more like an Englishman than an American, yeah? Americans tend to be a bit overstated, right? It's kind of the American way here. And the British are a bit more understated. The Buddha was, I think it's probably not quite fair to call him either British or American, probably kind of misses the point entirely, but just as a matter of interpreting the suttas. And then his mind is immersed in stillness, in samadhi. And then, because based on that, he then enters the jhana states, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities. I enter and remain in the first absorption. And then he goes into the second absorption, the third absorption, the fourth absorption. And then he has the three knowledges, the te vidya, that come after that. Ending in ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, and light arose, as happens for a meditator who is heedful, keen, and diligent. So that's all you have to be. If you are heedful, keen, and diligent, this is what happens to you. Yeah, the light arises, the darkness is destroyed, ignorance is destroyed, knowledge arises. So if you are heedful, keen, and diligent on the rest of this retreat, that is the outcome of that. Kind of nice, isn't it? It's nothing fancy, just doing the right thing, living in the right way, and that is what happens. So here you have the jhana state. I'm not going to say too much about that. We can come back to the jhanas later on. I can't remember now whether they come again later on during this these last few days that we have left. Unsure, maybe not. Anyway, I have to leave it out. We can come back to it anyway, even if it's not in there. Just very briefly, quite secluded from sensual pleasures actually means completely separated from the five senses. That's what that means. And it is not obvious when you hear sensual pleasures, but actually it refers to the five senses. Secluded from unskillful qualities means separated from the five hindrances. You enter and remain in the first absorption. And that is the first jhana state. Then all these other things happen and you end up fully enlightened. We'll come back to some of these details later on, but let's just finish off the sutta at the very end here. And then the Buddha says, Brahmin, he's still talking to this Brahmin Janusoni, you might think, perhaps Master Gotama is not free of greed, hate, and delusion, even today. And that is why he still frequents remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest. But you should not see it like this. I see two reasons to frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest. I see a happy life for myself in the present, and I have compassion for future generations. So the Buddha carries on living in the forest because that is how he feels happy. Away from people, away from the world, away from all the hustle and bustle, being able to attain samadhi easily, away from all the people who want to talk to him. There's a nice passage in the Middle Length Sayings, I think it's number 122, the longer discourse on emptiness, where the Buddha says that when you come out of a profound state of emptiness, you talk to people in a way that dismisses them. Yeah, so the king comes and he says, he kind of gives a short answer and he kind of looks at the clock, yeah. And then the king feels, oh yeah, I better go now, because he looks at the clock, yeah. there weren't any clocks in those days. That's kind of what some people do these days. I shall not say any names, but this is what sometimes happens these days. So, but you say something that kind of gives the impression, yeah, that you'd rather be alone, thank you very much. So very kind of you to visit me, but... And this is the Buddha, yeah, the mind inclines towards solitude, inclines towards stillness, inclines towards samadhi all the time. And I can see that a little bit with Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, when sometimes I go up and I ask Ajahn Brahm a question and I get the feeling he's not all that keen on engaging. And it's kind of fascinating, right? It's kind of very interesting to see that. And Ajahn Brahm says that generally his mind always inclines towards samadhi. So the moment he goes back to his kuti, sits down, his mind already is kind of inclining in that way. And because it's inclining in that way, it very rapidly goes back into those things. Ajahn Brahm closes his eyes, just leans against the wall, relaxes a little bit, and the joy comes and the nimittas comes and everything just happens, bang. This is how the master meditator does the samadhi, the stillness meditation. It's really awesome and really amazing when you hear how someone like Ajahn Brahm meditates. It's like, wow, is that possible? There's no real need to go to the breath or anything. The thing just, he knows his mind so well. He knows how to lean the mind, and things just happen in a kind of very powerful way like that. Very inspiring to hear that. And I get that feeling, Ajahn Brahm, his mind is always kind of leaning a bit towards samadhi. So if you feel that he is not engaging with you properly when you talk to him, that's probably because he's not engaging with you properly. That's probably the reality. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have compassion for people. He does have compassion, yeah? So if you really insist on talking, he will listen. He will be there with you. So sometimes it is okay sometimes to really insist if it is something that is important or something that is bothering you. It's fine. And he will honor that desire in you to have that conversation. But of course, don't bother him unnecessarily. That's also part of what this is about. So this is how the Buddha works, right? And so he enjoys the happy abiding for himself, and he has compassion for future generations. And again, this is the idea of leading by example, right? What the Buddha does, other people will follow in the same way later on. So this is about compassion for future generations. Let's just finish this off. There's only one paragraph left. And the Brahmin says, indeed, Master Gotama has compassion for future generations, since he is a perfected one, a fully awakened Buddha. Excellent, Master Gotama, excellent, as if he were writing the overturned, or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark, so people with good eyes can see what's there. Master Gotama has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. So this is a standard expression at the end when someone has really kind of enjoyed the Dhamma. And it is this beautiful a series here of similes, writing the overturned. The way we normally see the world, we see the world upside down. The reality is actually the other way around from how we see it. What an ordinary person sees as suffering, the noble ones see as happiness. What the noble ones see as suffering, the ordinary people see as happiness. We have overturned the world. We have a misunderstanding of what the world really is like. So you are writing the overturned, revealing the hidden. The world is hidden behind a veil, hidden behind curtains. And our job is to draw back the veil from the world, as it says so beautiful in some of the suttas, so we can see clearly what is there. Maybe we have a slight blurry feeling for what is happening behind the veil, but it's a very blurred kind of vision. We want to pull it back, gain clarity, gain real vipassana, see things clearly, and bang, it will have a massive effect on our lives. pointing out the path to the lost, yeah, finding the real path, not roaming around randomly in the world, not going anywhere without goal, without purpose, without aim, but instead find that path that has a real goal and a real purpose. And this is one of the epithets, one of the ways that the Dhamma is described in the suttas. The Dhamma is that thing which has a real goal. Usually human life has no real goal. It is just a random movement in the world. Yeah, moving according to cause and conditions, going this way and that way, feeling as if life is purposeful when actually it is completely random and ridiculous. This is kind of life for you. Lighting a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what is there. Yeah, the idea that we are in darkness. We don't know what is going on. One day the Buddha comes and turns on the light for us. And if we have eyes, if we have sufficient wisdom to be able to appreciate the light, then we will understand what is going on. And then we can do the right thing. Yeah. Beautiful little similes. They give a lot of idea of what is going on and what the problem is on this path. And then because he sees that, yeah, then he goes for refuge. Goes for refuge to the Buddha, goes to refuge to the Dhamma, goes for refuge to the Sangha. And this is another beautiful thing, the idea of going for refuge. Most people in the world, we go for refuge always to the wrong things. We go to the refuge to the world. We go to the refuge to things that are impermanent, uncertain, unreliable. Of course we're going to suffer. We take refuge in money, in possessions, in relationships, in all of these crazy things. And all of them are so utterly unreliable. And the only thing in the world that really is reliable is the Dhamma. The only thing that will always point you in the right direction, that will always be there to support you, is the Buddha, starting with the Buddha, the teaching coming from that, and then the noble Sangha arising out of those teachings. And that is why we bow down to the Buddha statue here, because we want to aspire for those same kind of qualities. That is where our refuge is. That is the place where refuge really works. Everything else is really impossible, and we are just asking for more suffering in our life. Okay, everyone, so that is it for this afternoon. And please carry on enjoying yourself. And we'll see you back again at 7 o'clock this evening. Yeah.